Pinkio. Our moment of truth.
Are you pondering what I'm pondering?
I think so, Braintooth. But a show about two talking lab mice? It'll never get on the air.
Hey, sexy. You want to have a blast? This is Political Dynamite.
Hi, I'm Michael Stewart with Taryn Lee in our studios in New York, and you're tuned to Political Dynamite. How you doing, Tara?
Very good, Michael. How are you?
Pretty good. We're used to having Adam McGavro in the studios with us, but he's no longer able to do the show, so Taryn Lee is filling in, and quite possibly as a permanent co-host.
Yes.
But she's also going to be starting your own show.
Yes, that's right.
What's it going to be called, Tara?
The Rainbow Room.
Rainbow Room, nice. What kind of things are you going to be talking about?
Gay and lesbian issues, just laws we're trying to get passed for, you know, equal, like, marriage, domestic partnerships, adoption, healthcare, benefits, just
basically
general,
all the things that
everything.
Bush wants to stomp out with both jackbooted feet.
Horror and moral terror are your friends.
Exactly.
Right? So, but it's going to be more than that too, right? You're gonna delve into the gay culture?
Yes.
In the gay community?
Yes.
Music, culture,
yeah,
things like that?
I'll discuss certain artists, any, you know, fundraising issues, stuff like that.
Things like that?
Yeah.
Oh, that's pretty cool. We look forward to that. That's awesome.
Mm-hmm.
Originally, we were going to do a program right after the State of the Union address, and all day, Wednesday and Thursday, we ran a promo that got some attention. We got some emails about it, and it's kind of funny, but Adam wasn't able to make that week's show. Actually, we're a week behind in programming right now. We missed a show, and surprisingly, we had some email about that. People were a little disappointed that we weren't able to air Political Dynamite right after the State of the Union address.
It's a great show.
Yeah, well, thanks. But we're going to, I just want to play the promo for you.
Yes.
That we aired for 2 days straight. And it got some email, some of it good, some of it bad, but we'll just air it right now.
Gonads are useful for their purpose, but they are no substitute for brains.
You know, Paul Harvey, you couldn't be more right. And that's why we're airing a special edition of Political Dynamite. It's our State of the Union edition, airing Thursday, 10 p.m. tomorrow night, Thursday, 10 p.m. on American Independence Radio, a special edition of Political Dynamite.
I love it when you talk dirty.
You're listening to American Independence Radio, a beacon of truth in a sea of lies, 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 lies.
So that was the promo that we ran.
Do you know what this is? This, my friends, is false advertising.
And, of course, we didn't get to do the show. But in a minute, we're going to play, it's an NPR report, it's a fact check, fairly informative of the president's statements in the State of the Union address. Did you get a chance to watch it, Tara?
Yeah, I watched some of it, and then I got a little sick, and I had to shut it off.
Yeah. I thought it was interesting, actually, to hear the Democrats, like you said, when we talked off the air, didn't really applaud for much.
No.
But in fact, booed at one point during the president's discussion of his social security destabilization program, I like to call it. But anyway, we'll go right now to what NPR aired as their fact check on the President's State of the Union address.
Throughout today's program, we're covering different aspects of the President's speech, and right now we're going to check some of the President's facts. The President offered a lot of information in support of his plans.
Do not let anyone mislead you.
That's what the President advised his audience about his plan to change Social Security. He was promising to keep benefits exactly the same for people over 55. For everyone else, however, the president said the system will be in trouble.
And by 2033, the annual shortfall would be more than $300 billion. By the year 2042, the entire system would be exhausted and bankrupt.
Many experts do say that the Social Security system faces trouble after the year 2042. That's the forecast of the system's own trustees. But NPR's John Itzde, who covers economic issues, says the president may have overstated the danger.
The fund will not be exhausted in 2042. In fact, there will be enough Social Security taxes coming in to pay about 70% of promised benefits in 2042. And it will continue to be able to pay about that much of benefits, again, throughout the 75-year horizon that the Social Security trustees look at.
If the president is playing up the dangers to Social Security, his opponents are playing up the dangers of the president's proposal to change it. In a brief response to the State of the Union speech last night, Democratic Senator Harry Reid made a dire warning.
It's wrong to replace the guaranteed benefit that Americans have earned with a guaranteed benefit cut of up to 40%. Make no mistake, that's exactly what President Bush is proposing.
Actually, the president did not formally propose a 40% benefit cut. Experts do say that a 40% reduction would be the result of one of several options to fix Social Security. The president did mention that option, among others, in his speech last night. Beyond Social Security, the State of the Union speech promoted another issue that's high on the president's agenda.
Justice is distorted, and our economy is held back by irresponsible class actions and frivolous asbestos claims. And I urge Congress to pass legal reforms this year.
When he said that lawsuits are hurting the economy, Mr. Bush caught the ear of John Cochran. Cochran covers legal issues for Congressional Quarterly.
I think the important thing to remember is that you have to take any claims about lawsuits or the economic costs of lawsuits either way with a big grain of salt. I mean, what's most striking about the whole tort debate is actually how little either side really knows about what's really going on out there. There's just a real lack of any kind of objective data.
This seems like an obvious statement. Lawsuits cost money, therefore they're a drag on the economy.
Yeah, and it's just not, economists say. First of all, nobody knows how much money flowing through the system is really excessive, which is part of Bush's argument, and how much is actually covering real injuries and real losses. And economists say, if I injure you and I pay you $150, what's lost? I don't buy a new suit, but you do.
There may also be little evidence to support a statement the president made last night about his education program.
Under the No Child Left Behind Act, standards are higher, test scores are on the rise, and we're closing the achievement gap for minority students.
Those who heard that statement include Steve Smith, a consultant to state governments. He formerly tracked education issues for the National Council of State Legislatures.
Well, I think it's interesting to note is he'd mentioned that test scores were up and the achievement gap has reduced, and I haven't seen any studies out there that show any of those in the aggregate to be true.
Smith says some individual states have improved. Then again, some states lowered their own standards to make it easier to meet those standards. If it's hard to keep track of educational progress, it can be even harder to keep track of the expanding federal budget deficit. That's another subject that President Bush mentioned to Congress last night.
I will send you a budget that holds the growth of discretionary spending below inflation, makes tax relief permanent, and stays on track to cut the deficit in half by 2009.
All the president's promises amount to a tricky equation. Here's NPR congressional correspondent David Wellner.
The remedy that the president is proposing for fixing the budget deficit doesn't address the fact that a very large part of the deficit is coming from defense-related spending. He's depending on the domestic discretionary spending, which is only 16% of the budget, to somehow bring this gigantic deficit down. And in fact, even the White House says that the deficit this year is going to be about $15 billion more than last year. And that's not even counting the $80 billion that they're going to ask Congress for keeping the war in Iraq going.
In his State of the Union speech, President Bush promised to continue the fight against terrorism. He also expanded on a sweeping theme of his second inaugural address, the drive to expand democracy abroad. He repeated his administration's commitment to democracy in Iraq, but one part of the speech underlined the complexity of spreading democracy elsewhere.
Syria still allows its territory and parts of Lebanon to be used by terrorists who seek to destroy every chance of peace in the region. You have passed, and we are applying the Syrian Accountability Act, and we expect the Syrian government to end all support for terror and open the door to freedom.
NPR's Tom Gelton has been tracking the Syrian Accountability Act.
This is, in fact, a law under which the United States government can take actions against Syria for supporting terrorism, but they're very sort of small-scale steps, such as downgrading bilateral diplomatic ties and imposing travel restrictions on Syrian envoys in the United States. And even those minor steps, the Bush administration up until now has been very reluctant to take, precisely because of the help that the Syrians have provided in the war on terrorism. So perhaps this signals a somewhat tougher line on Syria, but the record of this administration so far has been not to push Syria all that hard.
In some of the most powerful parts of his State of the Union speech, President Bush celebrated two achievements of recent months. Despite violent opposition and widespread skepticism, Afghanistan and Iraq both completed elections. But the president did not offer specific facts on a critical question for the near future. He did not give an update on the training of Iraqi troops. Those troops are eventually supposed to take over Iraq's security and make it possible for U.S. forces to leave. Last night, the president restated the goal that Iraqis should defend themselves, but he left for the future any judgment about how soon they might be prepared to take over. Those are some of the facts we reviewed from last night's State of the Union speech.
So that, oh, we're on the air.
Sorry.
Nice one. So that was a coverage of, that was NPR's fact check on the State of the Union address. And he seems to be hell-bent again, Taryn. It wasn't necessarily mentioned by NPR, but we'll mention here on Political Dynamite.
Yes.
That the president would like to reintroduce congressional amendment regarding the federal definition of marriage as between a man and a woman.
Mm-hmm.
Now, as a lesbian,
yes,
you, I'm sure, have an opinion on that.
Yeah, it's just a crock.
Yeah.
You know, so many states have it defined that marriage consists of two consenting adults.
Right.
You know, making vows to each other.
Right.
It doesn't state, you know, if it's a man or a woman.
Right.
And I was watching a show on TV before, and in the 1960s, what is it?
The riot?
The love? What was the name? It was a black woman and a white man.
Oh, I'm not sure.
Yeah, the last name was Love, I forget.
Okay.
But they wanted to get married, and they changed the law in Virginia in order to get married.
Regarding interracial marriage, right?
And it stated, you know, two individuals, and they changed it from, you know, man and woman, or it didn't say white woman and white. Yeah.
Right, yeah.
So
how do you feel about, do you feel this is like government's role?
No.
To define interhuman relationships?
No. It should have no part in it.
Right. I mean, I can understand, like, you can't marry your daughter or a close relative.
Oh, of course not, yeah.
I mean, there's consequences for that, like genetic mutations and, you know, and you don't want that, you know, three-headed babies and stuff.
Exactly, yes.
But as far as whatever the, there's no biological consequence between two men and two women who decide that they want to live together as a married couple.
Mm-hmm.
But, so there we have it. I'm sure that you're going to have plenty to say about that on the Rainbow Room.
I'll have a lot more to say on my show.
You know.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know what's baffling to me? Is that as we came out of the Clinton years, Tara?
Yes.
There was this gigantic surplus. How much was it?
$127 billion.
$127 billion surplus.
Yes.
You want to? I mean, yeah. Go ahead.
It's totally frustrating to me. In Bush's first year, he gave away his ridiculous tax credit to everybody in the United States, mostly benefiting the wealthy.
Right.
I got a tax credit. I think it was for like $200, $216, which, you know what, like when you're in your early 20s and like you're at your first job,
right,
or whatever, it helps.
That's $200, you know, is a lot of money.
Yeah, it definitely helps out.
Right.
But
he's prosecuted a war.
Yes, the war is what, up about like $300 billion?
Almost, I think.
Okay.
I think it's almost
somewhere
that,
there,
right?
Yeah.
And he's pushed the deficit to what now?
Not including the war, the deficit is about $116 million. $106 billion deficit.
$106 billion deficit. Mm-hmm. Probably those figures, it's probably a lot more now,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so he spent our surplus.
Yes.
And now he's looking to tamper with Social Security.
Yes.
And what's next? Right, and he spent it on a war that he lied about.
Yes, exactly. and two presidencies that he stole.
Right, right.
The Washington Post called it the swiftest plunge in the nation's fiscal health in half a century. That's
pretty... you know, and the Washington Post doesn't mess around.
Yeah.
You know?
They said it was worse than Bush 1 and Ronald Reagan.
Right.
And
if you think about President Clinton,
mm-hmm.
what a tremendous task that was
mm-hmm.
to not only eliminate the deficit, but create a surplus luxury economy
yes.
that could support social programs and do even more
uh-huh.
as a progressive. And I remember Clinton saying he said something. It was at his at the opening of the Clinton Presidential Library in one of his speeches, and he talked about being a progressive. And as a progressive, he saw himself as the best of both worlds, as the best of what it means to be conservative and the best of what it means to be a liberal. And in that sense, he meant that conservatives generally draw lines that you can't cross.
Mm-hmm.
And liberals seek to tear down barriers that shouldn't exist.
Yeah.
And he, I think, was successful at trying to bring together the best of those worlds, and at the same time garnering the cooperation of a Republican Congress, etc., to work on the deficit problem and bring in a surplus, and now it's gone.
It's gone.
And now the American dollar's tanking.
Yes.
And we're looking at the destabilization of Social Security, and eventually that's going to move through the rest of the social programs.
Mm-hmm.
I think we're going to see there's nothing to hold him back now.
Mm-hmm.
He's in his last term as president, but I think we're going to see drastic cuts in various other social programs, and I think that we're going to see it in Head Start. I think we're going to see it in Medicaid, Medicare, and things like that. So I think we're in for a rough ride, despite what the president has to say about the economy, etc. But, okay, we're going to move on now. Later in the program, we're going to have some news regarding the Iraqi election. The Sunni Iraqis are feeling marginalized. There's some interesting statistics regarding how they came out in the vote. And they didn't. Most did not vote. So,
no food for them.
That's right. You told me something interesting that you had discussed with another political analyst.
Yes.
About how successful
the...
Tell me about that. Tell me what you learned from that discussion. I know that we can't mention who it was.
Yes.
But what did they tell you?
Apparently, the Iraqi officials were informed to tell their people, if you don't go out and vote, the U.S. occupancy is going to be here a lot longer.
Right.
And also, you won't get your food ration cards. You'll be totally denied, you and your family. And
so in order to eat, you had to vote.
Yes.
That, you know what, and that's...
And you had to vote for the right candidate, too, I'm sure.
You know, I wonder if they... I wonder if they made that offer to the Sunnis, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Well, we'll see.
Yeah.
But that's interesting. I know that I've heard some reporting regarding that sort of coercion in the voting.
Mm-hmm.
Nonetheless, it's still impressive to a degree that so many people came out in the face of an incredible threat.
Yeah.
I think... to be fair, it is hats off to some of the Iraqi people that
mm-hmm.
that did make their way out of their homes
yeah.
with explosions in the background
yep.
And cued in election polling sites mm-hmm. and cast their vote. And, you know, regardless of the outcome of the election, mm-hmm. and under the gun of U.S. military occupation, maybe a Nobel Peace Prize should go to the Iraqi people that did go out and vote. You know?
Yeah.
Just a thought there.
Yeah. Well, what about for our election? How many more people went out to vote?
Right.
So that Bush wouldn't get back into office.
You know what? Maybe we need UN inspectors here to monitor U.S. elections. Mm-hmm. And what a whole nother can of worms that is. And I know this is territory walked on over and over again. But mm-hmm. this cannot happen again.
That's what we said after the first time.
You're right, but wow, what can we do, you know?
Yeah.
Well, I'm sure we're going to have plenty to say about that over as the midterm elections are coming up in a couple of years, and we'll keep a close eye, of course, on that. My name is Michael Stewart with Taryn Lee. You're listening to the American Independence Radio Network. Political Dynamite. We'll be back after these messages.
This is American Independence Radio.
American Red Cross,
UNICEF,
AmeriCares,
Save the Children.
These are just a few of the organizations where you can help provide relief for those who lost so much in the Southeast Asian tsunamis. Live365.com asks you, the Live365 community, to help in any way you can. Go to Live365.com/relief to find a list of resources where you can offer assistance in the way of donation. Communities helping communities, people helping people. Live365.com/relief.
And we're back. I'm Michael Stewart with Taryn Lee in our studios in New York. You're listening to American Independence Radio's Political Dynamite. And we're going to cover some Iraqi election news right now. Tara, I see you've got an article there that the Sunnis have a sense of marginalization in the election outcome, which is expected to be released this Sunday, February 13th. What have you got there for us?
Yes, this is an article from The Independent. It's called The Election Result Expected to Deepen the Sunni Sense of Isolation and Stir Further Unrest. Iraq will have to wait a few more days for final results of the election held 2 weeks ago, officials said yesterday. Most Iraqis blame the long delay on bureaucratic failings, but some are beginning to spread rumors that the ballot is being falsified or otherwise manipulated. Hmm. Provisional results were announced for provincial councils in 12 to 18 provinces, showing Shia religious groups winning in much of the country. The final results of the national poll is likely to confirm that the Shia coalition, known as the United Iraqi Alliance, has won a little over half the votes. It may end up with 143 to 145 seats in the 270-member assembly. But a simple majority of the new assembly is not enough to win control. For this, two-thirds of the seats are needed, a system devised to ensure that none of Iraqi's three biggest communities, the Shia, Sunni, or Kurds, can rule without the cooperation of one of the others. The Shia coalition will therefore need an agreement with the Kurds, who are expected to win between 75 and 80 seats. A surprise of the election was that the numerous smaller parties picked up few votes. The only one to do well was the Iraqi list of interim Prime Minister Iyad Alawi, which is expected to get 15-17% of the vote. It is extremely unlikely, however, that Mr. Alawi will be able to remain in the post, which will be something of a blow to the U.S. president. George Bush had received him in Washington as if he was the chosen representative of the Iraqi people and not an American appointee. Instead, the choice of prime minister seems to be narrowing down to Ibrahim al-Jarafi of the Dawa Shia Religious Party, or Adel Abdul Mahdi, the finance minister and a member of the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution in Iraq. The prime minister will only be selected after a president and two vice presidents have been appointed. In theory, the Shias have won power by their electoral victory, but real authority may prove elusive. The new government will depend, as did its predecessor, on the U.S. Army occupying Iraq. Most Iraqis say they want the U.S. out, but the new government dare not let them depart yet. The poll also deepened the Sunni-Arab sense of isolation. The Kurdish community was able to destabilize Iraq for half a century, and Sunnis say they are capable of doing the same.
That's interesting. And actually, for Bush, it will be a huge blow to lose Alawi, who is he's a documented CIA operative. Like, he's mm-hmm. been a close companion of the CIA for some time. And I'm sure a prime deal maker for Bush and others inside the political and economic realm of the right with respect to economic gains to be had in Iraq. So, in fact, I view that as a good thing that he's stepping out, but a really that potentially could step out. We're not sure yet, what apparently is emerging as a fact now is that the Sunnis being marginalized in this vote could just lead to more unrest.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, we have a audio segment from Democracy Now. You'll hear the voice of Amy Goodman interviewing Scottish Member of Parliament George Galloway regarding the legitimacy of the election in Iraq. We'll go to that now.
The elections in Iraq have been hailed as a resounding success both by President Bush and British Prime Minister Tony Blair. In a brief statement from 10 Downing Street, Blair said, quote, "Democracy in Iraq is not just good for Iraq itself. It's also a blow right to the heart of the global terrorism that threatens destruction, not just in Iraq, but in Britain and virtually every major country in the world." Not all British government officials feel the same way. Scottish MP George Galloway has been one of the most vocal critics of the Iraq War. He was expelled by his own ruling party, the Labour Party, in October 2003 after he was accused of encouraging British troops to disobey what he called illegal orders. Well, yesterday I was in England and Ireland as part of the International Exception to the Rulers book tour with my colleague, Democracy Now! Producer Elizabeth Press. Yesterday in London, we bumped into George Galloway outside of BBC studios and asked him about his thoughts on the Iraqi elections.
They're a farce. They're rigged. An election held under foreign military occupation is always, by definition, utterly flawed. But one which is held in the kind of conditions in which this one is being held is flawed beyond redemption. The facts are that it is simply impossible to hold an election when there's a full-scale war going on between the occupying armies and the resistance forces. The Sunni Muslim population, which if you add the Sunni Kurds and the Sunni Arabs together is some 40% of the population, are deeply anxious about the way in which the occupying forces are deliberately trying to divide the country along confessional lines. The Sunni Arab population has boycotted the election almost in their entirety. The Iraqis living outside, for whom security was not an issue, three quarters of them have voted with their feet and boycotted the election. Less than a quarter of the eligible voters have registered to vote, and fewer still have cast their votes. So this is a festival, a farce, that's been held to validate the American-British invasion and occupation of Iraq. But it will not validate it, neither in the eyes of the world opinion, nor, more importantly, in the eyes of those Iraqis who are resisting the foreign occupation. And the war will go on, I'm sorry to say.
So what do you see is going to happen, and what are you calling for?
Well, there's a very great danger of what I call the Yugoslavization of Iraq, the petrifying of the population on ethnic and confessional lines, and the country beginning a process of breaking up into three Iraqs, which is itself pregnant with many real dangers for the surrounding countries, not just Arab countries, but Turkey and Iran, which could very well lead to fighting over oil resources and a spreading of the conflagration which already exists there. We have a very simple demand. We say that the two leaders who caused this disaster cannot possibly be a part of its solution. Bush and Blair and their forces will have to go from Iraq. That's an absolute precondition for any resolution of this conflict, and they must talk with the resistance about how they're going to do that, over what period of time. It'd have to be a short period of time, but I'm sure it could be organized by agreement with the resistance forces. That sounds far-fetched today, but it will one day have to be agreed. Just like the American forces had to withdraw from Vietnam, so the American and British forces will have to withdraw from Iraq.
And what about the
population in Britain now? And what about today? Here we are at the BBC hearing all day the voices of people talking about going to vote and how exhilarated they are.
Well, we would like all the people of the Arab world to be able to go and vote in democratic elections. That's why, if we'd been alive, we would have opposed the British and French and other European colonization of Arab countries, where incidentally there was never a single election held that could remotely be described as a free and fair election. And it's why we're against all the dictatorships in the Arab world, who rule the Arab world almost without exception, from the Atlantic to the Gulf, mostly with the full support of Britain and the United States. And we want democratic elections in Iraq too, but these are not democratic elections, and these elections will solve nothing and may even add to the problems. But in Britain, now 29% of the population support the Iraq war, down from something like 68% at the height of the fighting and the fall of the regime in Baghdad. That's a pretty spectacular fall, and it will fall further still.
Finally, was it the Times of London, which newspaper settled with you and apologized?
Well, how long have you got? All of them have settled and apologized. The Daily Telegraph is the one I think you refer to, which was my biggest victory. They had to pay me £150,000 in damages and £1.6 million in damages.
Why?
Because they falsely claimed that I was in the pay of the Saddam Hussein dictatorship. The same kind of smear, utterly baseless, gigantic smear, that they leveled at so many sections of the anti-war movement. What they can't take, you see, is that we were right and they were wrong. They were the bugle blowers for one of the most disastrous foreign policy decisions ever taken by Britain or America. And I was amongst those who was telling them that this is going to end precisely in the way that it has ended. And they don't like that.
Your comment on the latest, we know about the Abu Ghraib prison scandal from U.S. soldiers. You have your own scandal with British soldiers, and then the Guantanamo Guantanamo prisoners returning home here to Britain.
Well, you see, the ironclad consensus of the mainstream political parties, the front benches, and the BBC and the other mainstream media outlets, like to reassure each other that this is conduct unrepresentative of British occupation forces. But I'm sorry to tell you, it's entirely representative. When Britain suppressed the Mau Mau freedom struggle in Kenya, they killed 100,000 Kenyans. Almost exactly the same number of Iraqis have been killed in the war and occupation. They used to cut off the limbs of Kikuyu tribespeople and pin them to the wall and take photographs of them. They used to pay British soldiers £5 per body for Kikuyu that they brought in. In Malaya, when we crushed the Malayan revolt for freedom, we killed 10,000 Malays. I've seen pictures of British soldiers holding the severed heads of Malay people for the cameras. This is how all occupations end. These things don't happen because the soldiers in question are American or British, any more than General Sharon's army behaves as it does because it's Israeli, still less because it's Jewish. They behave like that because they're occupying armies. And all occupations end this way. They end in the demonization, the subhumanization of the occupied people, a belief in the inherent superiority of the occupying forces, otherwise why should we be there reorganizing their societies? And that inevitably leads, when you're dealing with 17, 19, 21-year-old young men with weaponry against helpless civilian populations, it always ends in an Abu Ghraib.
British MP George Galloway. We were speaking yesterday in London.
So there we have it. George Galloway, Scottish Member of Parliament, with, I think, a brutally honest look at the Iraqi election and what's at stake. One of the most important points, of course, he reaffirmed what you just talked about with respect to how the Sunnis have been marginalized in the election. But another interesting point, and I think it's absolutely true, that a solution here for Iraq, I don't think, cannot be calculated and implemented by the people that have devastated it, namely George Bush and Tony Blair. I think it's perhaps time for them to move out fast, And hopefully with a true international coalition, maybe with United Nations support, it would be great to have that. I know that we've turned our back on the United Nations with respect to entering Iraq, but a legitimate international authority, with or without the Polish government on board, I think needs to come into play here and set into motion a way that would stabilize Iraq, generate a true democracy, and avoid what might be impending, as George Galloway discusses it, the splintering of Iraq into Kurds, Sunnis, and Shias, and further destabilization of the geopolitical situation there. So there we have that. But now, here's another thing that I wanted to talk about.
Yes.
And that's $8.8 billion. $8.8 billion. Let's say it together.
$8.8 billion
of Iraqi money is missing. That's more than losing your wallet.
Yeah, I get pissed if I lose $5.
Yeah. Right?
Yep.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So here we go from Reuters. This is January 30th. It's old news, but let's talk about it. The U.S.-led authority that governed Iraq after the 2003 invasion did not properly safeguard $8.8 billion of Iraqis' own money. And this lack of oversight opened up these funds to corruption, said a U.S. audit released on Sunday. The U.S. Special Inspector General for Iraqi Reconstruction was scathing in criticism of how the Coalition Provisional Authority handled Iraqi money until it handed over power last June to Iraq's interim government. The CPA provided less than adequate controls for approximately $8.8 billion in development funds for Iraq, funds provided to Iraqi ministries through the national budget process, said the report, released on the same day Iraqis voted in elections. We believe the CPA management of Iraq's national budget process and oversight of Iraqi funds was burdened by severe inefficiencies and poor management, it said. Geez, do you think? The DFI, the Development Fund for Iraq, is made up of proceeds from Iraqi oil sales, frozen assets from foreign governments, and surplus from the UN Oil for Food Program. Its handling has already come under fire by several UN-mandated audits. The report said the Coalition Provisional Authority, and we should mention now, at the time was headed by Paul Bremer, who recently received the Medal of Freedom, the highest honor that can possibly be bestowed upon by a non-military civilian.
I'll give you a Medal of
American
Freedom.
Citizen. The report said that the Coalition Provisional Authority failed to ensure funds were not used to pay ghost employees and cited one example where CPA officials authorized payment for about 74,000 guards, but only a fraction of these could later be validated. And I think that the number was around 6,000, or
yes,
it might have even been in the hundreds, I'm not sure.
It went from, I think it was around 6,000, and then when they delved further into it, it was maybe around 700.
Really?
Yeah.
Really? That's mm-hmm. pretty, that's a big difference.
Yeah, they couldn't contact the other, 6,300.
Right. Nobody was home.
No comment.
The audit said there was no assurance that the funds were used for purposes mandated by United Nations resolutions. UN auditors have also accused the Coalition Provisional Authority of sloppily managing billions of dollars of Iraqi oil money.
Imagine that.
Here's Bremer's response. former Coalition Provisional Authority Chief Paul Bremer, who received a Presidential Medal of Freedom last month for his work in Iraq. And
yeah,
what fine work it was. Did you notice that I didn't look, but because they didn't shoot him from the waist down when he got the medal?
Yeah.
Were his pockets really bulging? Like, is it possible that, you know, did they check his socks when he came in?
He didn't need a limo, he needed a forklift.
Yeah. So he got this Medal of Freedom last month for his work in Iraq, rejected the U.S. audit's findings, and said that it did not meet the standards that Americans have come to expect of the Inspector General. Quote, the draft report assumes that Western-style budgeting and accounting procedures could be immediately and fully implemented in the midst of a war, said Bremer in a written reply to auditors when he received the first draft. Now tell me, Western-style budgeting and accounting procedures could not be implemented in the midst of war? You know what? I think that I've got an answer for that. You get the guy, you get an accountant, and you put him in where next to Bremer, because
yeah,
Bremer can do his job.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody shot at him.
Yep.
He wasn't so worried, so just have the accountant sitting right next to him.
Yep.
But, you know, sometimes it takes two to tango, three maybe, and who knows, maybe that wouldn't be the best place to sit. But I think the point is that that could be done.
Yeah.
Certainly,
mm-hmm,
could be done. All right, so we'll continue. Bremer said any delays in paying Iraqi public servants' salaries would have raised the security threat to Iraqis and Americans and cost more lives. So there it is. It's like, we couldn't account for this because we were trying to save Iraqis and Americans. How much was that again?
$8.8 billion.
My, oh my. In addition, Bremer said the Iraqi ministries had no regular payroll systems, and the system had been corrupted beyond repair by decades of cronyism and ad hoc fixes. Pentagon spokesman Brian Whitman also disagreed, interesting, that with the audit's findings, and said the Coalition Provisional Authority had instituted a series of reforms, including actions to fight corruption. The Coalition Provisional Authority was operating, this is a quote, was operating under extraordinary conditions from its inception until mission completion. There's that word again.
Mission depletion.
Yeah, mission depletion. Good call.
Yeah.
Throughout, the Coalition Provisional Authority strived earnestly for sound management, transparency, and oversight, said Whitman in emailed comments to Reuters.
F+, that's my grade.
F+. The auditors said they understood the Coalition Provisional Authority was working in a dangerous environment, but it had a responsibility to ensure Iraqi ministries had basic financial controls before they were entrusted with handling such large amounts of money. The fact that the Iraqi ministries, this is a quote, ceased to or had never functioned, lacked basic tools, and operated in a cash economy was precisely why the CPA should have provided oversight of the financial management of the funds. A review of 10 payments made by the CPA Controller's Office between October 2003 and June 2004 found none of these, ranging between $120 million and $900 million, included documentation such as budget spending plans. They just gave it away. In another example, about $1.5 billion in cash allocations was made to Iraqi banks between January and April 2004 for operating expenses, yet spending plans supported only $498 million in these expenses. My, oh my. One of the main benefactors of Iraqi funds was Texas-based firm Halliburton.
What a coincidence.
Which was paid about $1.7 billion out of those funds. Oh, Taryn, what company did Dick Cheney run before he became vice president?
Halliburton.
You're absolutely right. Ding, ding. We have a winner. Halliburton was paid about $1.7 billion out of those funds to bring in fuel for Iraqi civilians. To bring in fuel.
Oh, my God.
Importing oil to Iraq. That's a new one.
Yes. UN
UN auditors have asked for a full accounting of these funds. Do you think they're going to get it?
Well, once they start drilling in Alaska, and then if they lifted all the EPA protection laws.
Oh, sure.
I'm sure they'll have to sell ice to the Eskimos.
Yeah. Okay, so with all that going on, I think maybe it's time to remind people why we went to Iraq. So I'm going to play a, it's going to be a clip of, it's a Bush speech at the Cincinnati Museum Center, which he delivered August 10th, 2002. Listen to this.
11 years ago, as a condition for ending the Persian Gulf War, the Iraqi regime was required to destroy its weapons of mass destruction, to cease all development of such weapons, and to stop all support for terrorist groups. The Iraqi regime has violated all of those obligations. It possesses and produces chemical and biological weapons. It is seeking nuclear weapons. It has given shelter and support to terrorism and practices terror against its own people. The entire world has witnessed Iraq's 11-year history of defiance, deception, and bad faith. We must also never forget the most vivid events of recent history. On September the 11th, 2001, America felt its vulnerability, even to threats that gather on the other side of the earth. We resolved then, and we are resolved today, to confront every threat from any source that could bring sudden terror and suffering to America.
So that was Bush reminding us again of the lie that brought us into Iraq. The threat of weapons of mass destruction, chemical, biological, and, of course, nuclear weapons, which were never found, and which the administration and the Defense Department had admitted as much last year in October, that they have not found any weapons of mass destruction or any evidence of a viable nuclear weapons program in Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
So, what are the results of this lie? Let's take a look at U.S. military deaths in Iraq as reported by the Associated Press today, February 12th. As of Saturday, February 12th, 2005, at least 1,457 members of the U.S. military have died since the beginning of the Iraq War in March 2003. According to an Associated Press count, at least 1,111 died as a result of hostile action, the Defense Department said. These figures include four military civilians. The AP count is seven higher than the Defense Department's tally last updated at 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, Friday, February 11th. The British military has reported 86 deaths, Italy 20, the Ukraine 18, Poland 16, Spain 11, Bulgaria 7, Slovakia 3, Estonia, Thailand, and the Netherlands 2 each, and Denmark, El Salvador, Hungary, Latvia, Kazakhstan, each report one death each. Since May 1st, 2003, when President Bush declared that major combat operations in Iraq had ended, 1,319 U.S. military members have died, according to the count by the Associated Press. That includes at least 1,002 deaths resulting from hostile action, according to the military's numbers.
You're tuned into American Independence Radio. This is Political Dynamite. We'll be back after a short break.
This is American Independence Radio.
You're listening to American Independence Radio, a beacon of truth in a sea of lies. Lies, 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 lies.
Hi, I'm Mike Stewart. We're back.
And I'm Taryn Lee.
And you're listening to American Independence Radio's Political Dynamite. We're in our final segment, Taryn, and I just want to spend some time again. Third show in a row. It's time for a rice beating. As we all know, she's been elevated to the post of Secretary of State. She's now the diplomatic face of American foreign policy around the world.
I take the truth lightly.
Very scary.
And I just want to go back and it's always good to know your friends, know who you're in bed with.
Oh, Catwoman. Catwoman, will you never learn?
Know who you sold your soul for.
Yeah. And so I want to go back right now. We're going to play a clip of Condi's testimony before the 9/11 Commission. Let's have a listen, shall we?
Okay. Isn't it a fact, Dr. Rice, that the August 6 PDB warned against possible attacks in this country? And I ask you whether you recall the title of that PDB.
I believe the title was Bin Laden Determined to Attack Inside the United States. The PDB,
you.
No, Mr. Benveniste, I would like to finish my point here.
I didn't know there
given
was
that
a point.
You asked me whether or not it warned of attacks.
I asked you what the title was.
You said, did it not warn of attacks? It did not warn of attacks inside the United States. It was historical information based on old reporting. There was no new threat information, and it did not, in fact, warn of any coming attacks inside the United States.
And I am asking you whether it is not the case that you learned in the PDB memo of August 6th that the FBI was saying that it had information suggesting that preparations, not historically, but ongoing, along with these numerous full-field investigations against al-Qaeda cells, that preparations were being made consistent with hijackings within the United States.
What the August 6th PDB said, and perhaps I should read it to you.
We would be happy to have it declassified in full at this time, including its title.
I believe, Mr. Benveniste, that you've had access to this PDB.
But we have not had it declassified so that it can be shown publicly,
I believe you've had access to this PDB, exceptional access. But let me address your question.
Nor could we, prior to today, reveal the title of that PDB.
May I address the question, sir? The fact is that this August 6th PDB was in response to the President's questions about whether or not something might happen or something might be planned by al-Qaeda inside the United States. He asked because all of the threat reporting, or the threat reporting that was actionable, was about the threats abroad, not about the United States. This particular PDB had a long section on what bin Laden had wanted to do, speculative much of it, in 97, 98, that he had in fact liked the results of the 1993 bombing. It had a number of discussion of whether or not they might use hijacking to try and free a prisoner who was being held in the United States, Rassam. It reported that the FBI had full field investigations underway. And we checked on the issue of whether or not there was something going on with surveillance of buildings, and we were told, I believe, that the issue was the courthouse in which this might take place.
time out whilst I think up some more deviltry.
So, Tara.
Yeah?
What do you have in front of you there?
I have the August 2001 memo to President Bush about Al-Qaeda.
Is that the presidential daily briefing? The
yes.
August 6th presidential daily briefing? What's the title of that?
Osama bin Laden determined to strike in U.S.
Osama bin Laden determined to strike in the United States. How about reading that for us?
Okay. Clandestine, foreign government, and media reports indicate Osama bin Laden, since 1997, has wanted to conduct terrorist attacks in the U.S. Bin Laden implied in U.S. television interviews in 1997 and 1998 that his followers would follow the example of World Trade Center bomber Ramzi Youssef and bring the fighting to America. After U.S. missile strikes on his base in Afghanistan in 1998, bin Laden told followers he wanted to retaliate in Washington, according to an unnamed service. An Egyptian Islamic Jihad operative told an unnamed service at the same time that bin Laden was planning to exploit the operative's access to the U.S. to mount a terrorist strike. The Millennium Plotting in Canada in 1999 may have been part of bin Laden's first serious attempt to implement a terrorist strike in the U.S. Convicted plotter Ahmed Rassam has told the FBI that he conceived the idea to attack Los Angeles International Airport himself, but that bin Laden Lieutenant Abu Zebediah encouraged him and helped facilitate the operation. Rassam also said that in 1998, Abu Zebediah was planning his own U.S. attack. Rassam says bin Laden was also aware of the Los Angeles operation. Although bin Laden has not succeeded, his attacks against the U.S. embassies in Kenya and Tanzania in 1998 demonstrate that he prepares operations years in advance and is not deterred by setbacks. Bin Laden associates surveyed our embassies in Nairobi and Dar es Salaam as early as 1993, and some members of the Nairobi cell planning the bombings were arrested and deported in 1997. Al-Qaeda members, including some who are U.S. citizens, have resided in or traveled to the U.S. for years, and the group apparently maintains a support structure that could aid attacks. Two Al-Qaeda members found guilty in the conspiracy to bomb our embassies in East Africa were U.S. citizens, and a senior EIJ member lived in California in the mid-1990s. A clandestine source said in 1998 that a bin Laden cell in New York was recruiting Muslim American youths for attacks. We have not been able to corroborate some of the more sensational threat reporting, such as that from an unnamed service in 1998, saying that bin Laden wanted to hijack a U.S. aircraft to gain the release of Blend Shake? Sorry.
That's all right. Try again.
Blind Sheikh Umar Abd al-Rahman and other U.S.-held extremists. Nevertheless, FBI information since that time indicates patterns of suspicious activity in this country consistent with preparations for hijackings or other type of attacks, including recent surveillance of federal buildings in New York. The FBI is conducting approximately 70 full-field investigations throughout the U.S. that it considers bin Laden-related. CIA and the FBI are investigating a call to our embassy in the UAE in May saying that a group of bin Laden supporters was in the U.S. planning attacks with explosives.
So, right here, where I'm pointing, about, can you read that section again, FBI information since that time?
Yes. FBI information since that time indicates patterns of suspicious activity in this country consistent with preparations for hijackings or other types of attacks.
Consistent with preparations for hijackings or other types of attack. Now, it seems to me, if you're the National Security Advisor...
That might be a little hint that something's going down.
Right. FBI information that is consistent indicates that patterns of suspicious activity in this country... consistent with preparations for hijackings or other types of attack. You'd think you would want to get ready for something like that, wouldn't you?
Yep.
And of course, she's sitting in this hearing going, I believe the title of the PDB was...
Did she swear in?
Yeah, she was sworn. Yeah.
Did she swear in as Condoleezza Rice?
So you didn't tell the truth.
Did you ever hear of a crook who did?
Condoleezza Rice. Let me, here's some commentary. This was published in News from the Pulpit, May 29th, 2003. But it's important about what they knew. which was more than just this PDB. This PDB is late in the string of information that was available to Condoleezza Rice as the National Security Advisor to the President, George W. Bush. So this is Michael Nieman. He's a professor of media studies at the State University of New York at Buffalo. In 1996, Bill Clinton had an affair with White House intern Monica Lewinsky. On September 11, 2001, terrorists hijacked four jetliners and used them to attack the Pentagon and destroy the World Trade Center. The Lewinsky affair involved a White House intern performing oral sex on the president.
I love it when you talk dirty.
Congress created an independent office to investigate the affair and appointed a special prosecutor to prosecute any individuals caught breaking the law. The affair dominated the world media for 2 years and ultimately led to Clinton's impeachment. The September 11th attacks killed 3,000 Americans. The ensuing domino effect resulted in the death of over 10,000 Afghans and Iraqis, the collapse of the U.S. economy, the decline of the American dollar. It also led to the onset of political amnesia regarding Enron, remember that fiasco, Tara? And other corporate scandals, conflicts of interest running rampant in the Bush regime, and the illegitimacy of the 2000 presidential election. To date, however, and this is a dated commentary, to date, however, there's not been an independent investigation of the events leading up to the September 11 attacks. A bipartisan committee appointed by Congress and led by former Pentagon Inspector General compiled an 800-page report primarily about intelligence community warnings prior to September 11th. It was compiled in December, but its release has been suppressed by the Bush administration. It's nothing short of outrageous that as we approach the second anniversary of the September 11 attacks, and I remind you this was written in 2003, we still have not seen the results of any investigation regarding these charges. This despite a plethora of disturbing international press reports raising horrifying questions about Bush administration complicity, duplicity, or incompetence.
I was told in instructional period that some people are just naturally slow. That doesn't mean they're actually stupid. They're just slow.
Only a few congressional voices are calling for hearings that in all likelihood will never take place. The report, according to preliminary releases dating back to last year, that would be 2002, demonstrates, that U.S. intelligence agencies were aware of al-Qaeda's plans to use commercial airliners as terrorist weapons and made those concerns known to George W. Bush and his top advisors, which no doubt would include Condoleezza Rice. Weeks before September 11, the Central Intelligence Agency reported to the White House that Osama bin Laden's network was planning imminent attacks on U.S. soil which would be spectacular and designed to inflict mass casualties. They went on to warn that the attack will occur with little or no warning. The report, according to Newsweek, names names, gives dates, and provides a body of new information about the handling of many other crucial intelligence briefings, including one in early August 2001 given to National Security Advisor Rice that discussed al-Qaeda operations in the United States and the possibility that the group's members might seek to hijack airplanes. These briefings followed warnings issued to the White House by Italian, Israeli, Jordanian, Egyptian, Tunisian, Moroccan, Russian, Malaysian, Filipino, and British intelligence agencies, which reported that al-Qaeda was planning a major terrorist operation in the United States. Many of these agencies accurately speculated upon both the targets and the means by which they would be attacked. The Filipino report, according to the New York Times, detailed a cross-country odyssey of one would-be terrorist as he attended flight schools in New York, Texas, California, and North Carolina in order to learn the skills needed to precisely fly a jumbo jet directly into a building. The FBI, in Oklahoma as early as 1998 in a memo titled Weapons of Mass Destruction warned that suspicious foreigners were receiving flight training for no apparent reason and that they might be part of a plot to use airliners in the manner they were eventually used on September 11th. In the months leading up to September 11, other FBI offices around the country followed suit, warning about the potential use of airplanes as terrorist weapons. In the most recent warning, came out of the Phoenix office in July 2001. Officials in Minneapolis had already identified Zacharias Massawe as one of the would-be hijackers. The Bush administration's only visible responses to these warnings were Attorney General Ashcroft's July 26, 2001 decision to stop flying on commercial airliners and the administration's now documented order for the FBI to back off its investigation of Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden. The congressional report was completed in December 2002, despite a lack of cooperation from key players such as Condoleezza Rice, Colin Powell, and Donald Rumsfeld. On December 10th, both the Senate and House Intelligence Committees determined that the report contained no classified information and voted to release it to the public. The Bush administration, however, argued that the report still needed to be scrubbed of classified information and blocked its release for at least 5 months. I remind you again, this was published in 2003. They did this by declaring major sections, such as those detailing when George Bush was informed and what he was informed of, to be classified information whose release would compromise U.S. security. Critics point out that what the report would actually compromise is Bush's 2004 presidential election campaign. Early indicators show that with unemployment and the deficit skyrocketing, public services declining, the economy in ruins, environmental degradation increasing, public education and healthcare going to hell, and chaos reigning in Central Asia and the Middle East, a re-election for a never-elected president would be hard to sell. Hence, the emerging Republican strategy is to wrap Bush in the flag and rerun lots of September 11 United We Stand footage, pushing the wartime president myth. To this end, the Republicans scheduled their convention planned for New York City to occur early in September 2004. This will be the latest date that the Republicans have ever held a convention, but it promises a priceless tie-in with September 11 commemorative events. That was Michael Nieman, a professor of media studies at the State University of New York at Buffalo, writing a fairly detailed assessment of what these people knew before 9/11. We have a little bit of time left. I just want to... we're going to play Richard Clark. I'm sorry, I'm a little upset. We're going to play Richard Clark's testimony before the 9/11 Commission with respect to the warnings he had issued to the administration and Ms. Rice prior to 9/11.
My impression was that fighting terrorism in general and fighting Al-Qaeda in particular were an extraordinarily high priority in the Clinton administration, certainly no higher priority. There were priorities probably of equal importance, such as the Middle East peace process, but I certainly don't know of one that was any higher in the priority of that administration. I believe the Bush administration in the first 8 months considered terrorism an important issue, but not an urgent issue. President Bush himself says as much in his interview with Bob Woodward in the book Bush at War. He said, "I didn't feel a sense of urgency." George Tenet and I tried very hard to create a sense of urgency by seeing to it that intelligence reports on the Al-Qaeda threat were frequently given to the president and other high-level officials. And there was a process underway to address Al-Qaeda. But although I continued to say it was an urgent problem, I don't think it was ever treated that way. This administration, while it listened to me, didn't either believe me that there was an urgent problem or was unprepared to act as though there were an urgent problem.
So that was Richard Clark testifying before the 9/11 Commission about the contemptible disregard of the Bush administration for the warnings. He had presented it early in 2001. It should also be noted, and we don't have time for me to read this whole article, but this was published in The Guardian April 8th, 2004, and it's fairly well known, but it should be reiterated that the Hart-Rudman Commission had briefed Ms. Rice and others in the Bush administration regarding specific and serious threats to the United States, and that he also believes that they had not taken the information seriously. Quote, she said, "I'll discuss it with the vice president," Mr. Hart said, but he felt the response was a brush off. Again, they met in February of 2001. He and the other commissioners of the Hart-Rudman Commission, they briefed Ms. Rice, the Secretary of Defense, Donald Rumsfeld, and the Secretary of... You okay over there? You got a little frog in your throat. And the Secretary of State, Colin Powell, to convey their fears personally. Quote, they were respectful and attentive and interested in what we were saying, but nothing was done. So there we have it. Ms. Rice botching American national security by ignoring these reports. And she's now our new Secretary of State.
Holy nightmare!
Ter, any final thoughts on our this week's Rice beating?
I can't wait for next week's. Let's see what else she can blow.
Right. But I don't know. I'm disappointed with the people in our Senate. I think that there are a few of you out there, and they are Democrats, who have the courage to stand up and speak against this kind of negligence, or perhaps collusion. We're not sure yet. Hopefully someday we will be. But to Senator Barbara Boxer and others like her, I hope that you'll continue to stand up for what's right. And for those of you who know better, those of you senators who know better,
shame
but are
you.
Pulling the party line, shame on you. And I hope that the people in your states will be true patriots and vote you out. Because it's time for honesty in American government and compassion. You're tuned to Political Dynamite. We've gone over, Tara. I'm Michael Stewart.
I'm Taryn Lee.
And you're listening to the American Independence Radio Network. This has been Political Dynamite. We'll see you again with a new volume next week. Thanks for listening.
Good night.
You're listening to American Independence Radio, a beacon of truth in a sea of lies, 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 lies.
Hi, this is Michael Stewart from American Independence Radio. You've been listening to Political Dynamite. We would love to hear your comments. Please email us at AmericanIndependenceRadio@hotmail.com. That's AmericanIndependenceRadio@hotmail.com. We'd love to hear from you, and we might even read your email on the air. Thanks for listening.